Boy, that's quite a mouthful. Thank you, Gustavo. And good morning, and I'm really excited to be sharing the podium this morning with such a distinguished panel. And I want to confess right up front to a little bit of a bait and switch. You see the word up there, seroconversion. What I'm really talking about is diagnosis of HIV. Seroconversion is something that we really can't determine with any real certainty out of surveillance data, so I apologize for the bait and switch. Well, I'm going to be talking this morning mostly about HIV among persons with gonorrhea, and mostly this is because of things that folks in this room know really well. We know that there's an emerging syndemic between bacterial STDs and viral STDs, and HIV in particular. In Washington State, over the last decade, we've done some work and really been able to identify that we have a fairly high incidence of all bacterial STDs among persons who are HIV positive. And more recently, in just the last couple of years, looking at new HIV cases in our surveillance data, we've noted that many folks that are being diagnosed with HIV also have a history of gonorrhea from our registry matchings. And something that I think everyone in local and state public health departments are familiar with is that we really do have decreasing resources. So where we have a capacity for partner management activities and partner services, we really need to begin to prioritize those to begin to save some of these precious resources and to get the best bang for our buck. In Washington State, we currently interview a random sample of all gonorrhea and chlamydia cases that are reported statewide. All of our jurisdictions are participating in a point of case report randomization to interview patients for partner services, but many jurisdictions appropriately have also established some other targets for folks that they think are particularly important to manage the partners for persons that are diagnosed with GC. And in many of our jurisdictions, they've intuitively made the decision to target those who are HIV positive, where they can determine that at the time the case is diagnosed with gonorrhea. Certainly, men who have sex with men, who we know are at particular risk for HIV infection. But we really don't have the evidence base. Most of this is sort of seat of the pants, good anecdotal information. And what we'd like to do with our surveillance data, and to quote Robert Browning, we're going to make our grasp exceed our reach here with surveillance data this morning. We really need to use that to begin to provide that evidence base for better targeting our partner services. And really, this is also part of the larger context of beginning to try to better integrate most of what we do with bacterial STDs as well as our HIV infrastructure, because we're really seeing so much population level overlap. Well, what's happening with gonorrhea among males in particular in Washington State, because I will be focusing on men for the purposes of this presentation. And what we've seen over the last decade through to the middle part of this last decade, we really saw an increasing trend in gonorrhea infections among males. Now, we've seen some turnaround in that since 2006, but generally over the decade, the trend is still increasing. Well, when we look at persons who are HIV positive, we see very similar trends, and it's very promising to look at the last couple of years and to see that chart on the right decreasing. However, we don't know how cyclic this is going to be and whether that's going to be a long-term trend that will be preserved over time. With respect to HIV incidence in Washington State, our incidence has been remarkably stable at somewhere between 8 and 10 cases per 100,000. And really, it hasn't budged in almost 10 years, that we're seeing very flat and stable incidence, as is the case in many jurisdictions around the United States. Well, what were we trying to do? We wanted to look at our surveillance data, and in Washington State, as in many other jurisdictions, we've really concentrated on trying to improve the nature, completeness, validity, timeliness of our surveillance data so that we can begin to look at, in a complicated and more sophisticated way, some of our surveillance data. And this study, we're attempting to look at men diagnosed with gonorrhea in Washington State and to look for what are the characteristics that we can determine from our surveillance data that are associated with their subsequent risk of diagnosis of HIV. And among those that are diagnosed with HIV subsequent to being diagnosed with gonorrhea, is there something that could indicate to us a priori from information about the case that's reported to us that these folks are at more imminent risk of HIV diagnosis than others? Well, what we did was we looked at all of the males that were diagnosed in with gonorrhea between 1992 and 2008. We've been, over the last decade, routinely matching these data across to our surveillance registry for HIV disease, which is called HARS. And so we have a linkage between these two registries. So we're able to pull those data, look at the match with our HIV surveillance data, and then to calculate the time of diagnosis from the most recent gonorrhea case for those who are not known to be HIV positive prior to being diagnosed with HIV. So what we did was we took data from both surveillance systems, where we could update information that was missing in one surveillance system from data that were present in the other. We did that. We looked at a bivariate analysis to look at the outcome of, did this person subsequently get diagnosed with HIV infection? We tried to model that to try to understand better what were the factors that helped to explain or were associated with HIV diagnosis subsequent to gonorrhea. And then we sort of looked at what are potentially some of the characteristics that are associated with the shorter time beyond getting diagnosed with HIV or with gonorrhea to HIV infection. Well, I don't know what happened to the axes because they looked great on my machine this morning, and they also looked great in the ready room downstairs. So without axes to show you, I don't quite know what to do with that slide, except to tell you that what we did basically was we did a descriptive analysis. We sort of just threw the descriptives out there by characteristics to look at our entire study population. And one thing we noted was that our study population was roughly equal between non-Hispanic whites, non-Hispanic blacks, although about 20% were missing race and ethnicity. Overwhelmingly, our cases of gonorrhea were heterosexual, about 90%. 10% were MSM. And there are a number of other characteristics that I'm hoping I can show you a little bit better in later charts. So I'm going to have to move through this fairly quickly without an axis to really give you an idea of what's there. But what we did note as we looked at the descriptive data, and these are by race and ethnicity, by presumed MSM or presumed heterosexual risk. We looked also at whether or not folks were being diagnosed in STD clinic settings or in other settings. We looked at the site of infection because we have that on our case reporting data for persons with gonorrhea, whether it was a urethral infection or pharyngeal or rectal infections. And we also looked at age of diagnosis of the GC case, and we categorized that as those who were less than 30, 30 to 39, and 40 that were greater. In bivariate analysis, what we found were some pretty significant differences between all gonorrhea cases and those who were subsequently diagnosed with HIV among males. And we also calculated a very crude cumulative incidence in this cohort. And for non-Hispanic whites, it was about 6.4%. For MSM, we calculated a crude incidence of about 30%. Of gonorrhea cases among males who were MSM were subsequently diagnosed with HIV according to our surveillance registry. Now there's some caveats on that high cumulative incidence. Prior to 2007, we really only ascertained the true MSM status of cases for those that were interviewed, although we did interview and have been interviewing historically about 50% of all cases that are reported to us. When we looked by age, 30 to 39-year-olds were likely, much more likely than others to be diagnosed subsequently with HIV, and that was a cumulative incidence of about 4.9%. Those who were resident in metropolitan area versus our rural areas, and we define that really as the counties in the Seattle metropolitan area, those with a non-urethral site of infection, and this is clearly no surprise to clinicians, were more likely to be diagnosed subsequently with HIV infection. And those coming from our fast-shrinking STD clinical infrastructure were also more likely than others to be diagnosed subsequently. Well, when we adjusted this, trying to throw it all into the mix, what we found was that the strongest predictor was MSM behavior. And because in 2007 we began nationally as well as locally to try to get reports of gender of sex partners on provider case reports, this is important to us because it's something that we can use to more appropriately target partner services. Well, we also looked at this time to HIV diagnosis. So what I did was I really looked at the life tables and looked at them by various strata, looking for significant differences in survival time to an HIV diagnosis among our cohort. And really the most striking feature of these stratifications was to look at MSM. And again, this really indicates a much higher risk of subsequent HIV diagnosis among this group. And the median time to diagnosis from a GC episode was 17 months for persons who reported MSM risk versus 37.5 months for all of those who did not. When looking at it by non-Hispanic white versus all other non-Hispanics, the median time to diagnosis was, again, 17 and a half months versus 20 for those who were non-white. Two more strata we examined in this analysis were Hispanic versus non-Hispanic. What we found is that Hispanics had the shortest median time to HIV diagnosis following a GC episode, and there may be a lot of reasons for that. It might be that these folks are later in their HIV illness for lack of access and other reasons, versus non-Hispanics, which was 19 months median. Well, we also threw this into a regression model to try to see if there was something that emerged from that model. And what we found was that the strongest predictor, again, was MSM, followed by Hispanic ethnicity, STD clinic, and age 30 to 39, being the most robust predictors of subsequent diagnosis with HIV infection. Well, what are the implications and the conclusions here? First and foremost, your intuition is right smack on. Those who have been doing this work for a while clearly have good intuition about who are at greatest risk when they're being diagnosed with gonorrhea among men. Certainly those who report MSM behavior should be prioritized for partner services. And then we really need to look at the quality of our surveillance data, because I'm stretching these data to the absolute breaking point in doing this analysis. And what we would like is to be able to better ascertain some of the missing information in our surveillance cohorts, because we actually spend a great deal of resources doing surveillance, and if we're not able to collect information of sufficient quality to help us target our resources, what's the point, you might have to ask. And, you know, our future efforts are really going to focus on partner services. What are the interventions that are going to be efficacious in maybe changing that survival time statistic? Longer time periods before an HIV diagnosis, or avoiding that diagnosis completely. And really, we only have a couple of things going for us. Either we get people to change their behaviors, which hasn't been particularly efficacious in many of the interventions that we've tried, or we have people test more frequently and be able to reduce potentially the lag time to them identifying their infection, because we do know that people that know their status are somewhat less likely to engage in risk behaviors for transmission. And then really, we're beginning to add a level of geographic information to our surveillance infrastructures that we've never had before. And this notion of being able to better target our resources should not only be looking at populations that we need to reach, but also where they are, so that in a much more targeted way, we can allocate our resources geographically to where there's the highest risk. Well, surveillance data are about as messy as they come. There may be missing cases not reported to us. Case information is incomplete. There's certainly a lag time in reporting of HIV cases. Race, ethnicity, and other demographic information are often missing in our cases, so it's really hard to do these kinds of analyses to really determine what the overall risk is by these strata. And then there are some issues about matching and merging registries. These may not be sensitive enough to pick up all of the cases that exist across registries, or we actually may miss some true matches. Want to make quick acknowledgments. First, our co-collaborators and co-authors at Seattle King County Public Health and the University of Washington, Dr. Golden, Roxanne Karani, our STD Services Section Manager, Mark Aubin, and then I also want to put a shout-out, and I hate doing shout-outs, but the real unsung heroes when it comes to STD surveillance data are our surveillance coordinators, and a special thanks to Julie Simon, our surveillance coordinator in Washington State.
Terrific presentation. Okay, if you have any questions for Mark, if you could please step to the microphone. We have about 5 minutes for questions.
Great presentation as always, Mark. I think I saw that a non-Hispanic non-Hispanic race ethnicity was associated with HIV infection following diarrhea, even when controlling for sexual orientation. That's sort of a surprising observation compared to most data we see, if I understood things correctly.
That's correct, Michael, and it was surprising to us as well when we controlled for everything. There were some differences there between rural versus metropolitan Hispanics, and really the metro sort of swamps the rural in that. We were surprised to see it too. It's not particularly robust in terms of a predictor, and the numbers in our cohort were fairly small. So I think we really need to do some more work to understand what's going on there. Among Hispanics? Yes. Yes, we did. It held for both. Only when we entered these predictors in the model stepwise, when we threw it all in and let it compete equally for the variance, it sort of washed out.
Okay, we have a question over here. The young man in the blue shirt.
Hello, my name is Amish. I'm from Oklahoma. So I have a question. Do you know that STD and HIV share more or less the same risk factors? More frequent they are in a particular subgroup population, more likely they are to have a co-infection. That is very intuitive and common sense. And of course, the literature says that NSM are maybe more likely to have higher sexual risk behaviors, which kind of makes it to be right the findings that were found. My question is with this and also with the simplex presentation that we just saw earlier. Is that so what? I mean, if there is co-infection, is there a long-term risk factor for the survival, for mortality, for drug resistance, either for HIV or maybe drug resistance towards pneumonia and other things? So are these factors which you're concerned, or are these factors that you're aware of maybe like this?
That is a very good question. The question is really, so what? So we have co-infection. What really does that mean in terms of survival with HIV disease, or for that matter, with morbidity associated with STDs? And that's a good question. Certainly we know that infection with bacterial and inflammatory STDs will enhance receptive acquisition of HIV as well as transmission. So from the standpoint of preventing HIV disease, you know, certainly if we can work with a cohort of persons being diagnosed with STDs to prevent acquisition of HIV, that's a good thing. Because lots of different reasons in terms of lifetime illness and suffering, as well as the cost burden that society bears for HIV infection. So I think your point is well taken. Really, why is it important? What we certainly wouldn't want to do is attempt to look at a population such as HIV-infected persons and deny to them the same sexual lifetime experiences that other people enjoy. What we see is a high burden of disease in the community in terms of gonorrhea and syphilis infection. And I think that represents a health disparity, a health inequity that we might be able to better address with these kinds of information.
Okay, one last question.
Thank you, Pam. That's a very good question. And the question relates to, do we have good information about the differential rates of testing between the various strata that we looked at? We do know from, we do a knowledge attitudes and behaviors survey every couple of years and are able to stratify that by MSM versus presumed heterosexuals. And we do know that MSM test at a much higher rate. So there are actually a couple of different things in what you brought up. we're probably much more likely to see people who are symptomatic with gonorrhea, who are also HIV positive, getting diagnosed with the gonorrhea because they're accessing care on a routine and regular basis that many other people may not be. And they may be more likely to be diagnosed with HIV infection when they're asymptomatic because of their higher rates of screening. So both of those things are very important, and you know, we're certainly going to have to look at how to adjust our data for those findings.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. All right.